Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 20 minutes, we're going to talk with Dr. Victor Raj about the Gandhi legacy in India. The story from this weekend brought the name Gandhi back to our attention, and we'll talk about that family that has in one form or another ruled in India since 1947. And we'll also talk about India, its religious makeup. This is fascinating stuff, folks, and stuff that we very seldom get in the news here, because how often do you read about India in the news? Well, we'll be talking about it in the last 25 minutes of the program. Before the break, Jeff called in. I want to recommend several books. Now, in terms of sharing the gospel, you divide this into two different ways. If you have a skeptic on your hands, who has the task of apologetics is to destroy the smug skepticism of the unbeliever, okay? Because sometimes that needs to be knocked out, okay? They believe that they know the truth. If the issue is apologetic, then the book like Lee Strobel's book is great. There's one I'm going to have Jeff run down and get off my shelf from Dr. John Warren Montgomery that I forget the name of. But in terms of preaching the gospel, the best book I can recommend to someone who needs to be initiated to the basics of the Christian faith in a solid way, the book is called Dying to Live by Harold Sankbile. It is the best book. It covers all the bases. And although it is written as a catechism of sorts, very popularly written, by the way, it is written primarily for the unbeliever. This is what I used when we did information courses in the church as a parish pastor. When someone came in and said, I want to join your church, this is the book we used. It's called Dying to Live by Harold Sankbile. Just get it off of Amazon.com. It's not hard to find. If we assume that the gospel has not yet been spoken between two people, the time to speak that gospel is when you have them face to face. Don't let the book do the talking for you. And that was the point I was making with Jeff. There's a book by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery called Faith Founded on Fact. Now, if you're dealing with someone who's got a few brain cells to rub together, then I would give them this book, because Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is not light reading, but it is the top of the line. It is top drawer apologetics. Someone who can respond point for point intelligently, consistently, and thoroughly to the objections of the skeptic. That would be probably the premier book. Faith Founded on Fact, Essays in Evidential Apologetics, John Warwick Montgomery, regular guest here on the program, is the man there, if that's what you're looking for. It makes Strobel's, it is the Hummer of the, and Strobel's is the Schwinn, okay? They both get you there. One of them does it with a lot more horsepower. And Strobel's will be infected by, as Jeff well knew, a decision theology that could do more harm than good. So forget Strobel, do Montgomery there. Suzanne Venker joins us here for this 25 minutes in the third hour of the program, part two of a 7-part daily series we're doing with Suzanne on working mothers and the myths that surround working motherhood. Suzanne Venker is author of the new book, 7 Myths of Working Mothers. She's a former middle school English teacher, and she joins us here again. Suzanne, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd.
The myth we're going to deal with today has, I could never stay home full time. You have written, and to begin our response, you have written that motherhood is the most elusive profession in the world. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that there's a quote by a woman named Anne Crittenden who wrote The Price of Motherhood. And in that book, she says, like the work of a fine seamstress, tiny stitches that build character and confidence are invisible to the naked eye. And I borrowed that phrase in this chapter to make the point that raising children and the work that takes place kind of behind the scenes when no one is looking is work that you cannot quantify in the way you can other jobs. You know, you can't put a specific number on it as far as what's taking place from day to day. And it's actually within what appears to be very trivial communications or trivial activities that go on day to day that make up who we are as a human being, and that is exactly what motherhood is. And so the problem is that that's what makes it so difficult to discuss it in a kind of a tangible way, in the way that we would our outside jobs, you know, careers, for example. So it makes it seem as though not a whole lot is taking place there, when in fact quite the opposite is true.
I guess one person says, look, a woman would say, look, I went to high school, and then I intentionally went on to college, and I've had my children, and I do want to stay home with my children, but I don't see wasting my whole education that way.
Yeah, well, there's several ways that we can look at that. The first thing that comes to mind is this idea that just because you have an education, that if you're not putting it to use every single year throughout your lifetime, once you graduate from school, that it's somehow wasted. You know, your education is an investment for life. It's not going anywhere. That's one thing. Secondly, of course, we change over the years. So what we think we might have been interested in, oftentimes, when we're younger, is not always what we decide to stay in. And so that education isn't usually, especially today, specifically geared toward one certain career path, and that if you don't stay on it, you're doomed. And that's the case whether you even talking about motherhood or not. Lots of people veer away from what they thought they were going to do. But on another level, of course, there's another way of looking at that, and that is that those years that you have at home can be not only educational for you as a woman to kind of look at the world again through children's eyes and learn all kinds of things from them, but it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it, to impart what knowledge we have gained onto our children, because common sense would dictate, of course, that when these women with higher degrees go back out into the workforce and find alternate care for their children, they are invariably getting for them, usually, less educated individuals to do that work. And so that's kind of a sad commentary, too, that we would choose that over doing that work ourselves.
The picture that we often get from the popular media is that you are either the 60-hour-a-week, 40-at-a-minimum hour-a-week working mom who juggles all things and has it all, or you opt out of life and stay home and you don't work outside the home at all. Do the real figures support that kind of two-track picture that is portrayed for us?
No, not at all. And that is one of the things that kind of irked me in my research. And one of the reasons that I even wanted to write the book is to dispel this myth of what you just described. The truth of the matter is that only 41% of women who have children under the age of 18 are actually working full-time and year-round. So that group, that 41%, would be what we would consider those working mothers. Then out of the rest, you're left with 32% who work part-time and 27% who are at home and not employed. Now, what the media does is they lump the 41% figure that I initially gave you, the full-timers, with the 32%, the part-timers, and you get, you know, approximately 70%. So then the media likes to say, oh, the majority of mothers are now in the workforce, because technically they're not lying. The problem is that they're not differentiating between the part-timers and the full-timers. And this is there's an enormous gap there, because it could be the difference between whether you are being your children's primary caregiver or you are basically farming out that work to daycares and nanny. Because the part-timers are described as anyone who brings home an income of even $1 an entire year. So I have a friend, for example, who does some tutoring on the side. She's a full-time mom. She has two children. She does some tutoring, and she'd be considered a working mother, according to the media.
See, I think about my wife's situation. She teaches,
uh-huh.
And that means her hours away from the home coincide exactly,
sure,
with the children's, who are school-aged
That's
kids,
right.
Away from the home. There is never a moment when the kids are, never.
Sure.
There's seldom a moment when the kids are at home from school when she's not there with them. For all intents and purposes, she could be flying to Mars in the hours
That's right.
that they're
That's
at
exactly
school,
right.
But she's there when they get home.
Right, and she would be a part-timer, because she's not year-round, I'm assuming. She's got the summer, so she's not considered year-round and full-time in that way. But, of course, it doesn't matter, because she's lumped in with the people who are working 60, 70 hours a week when they have young, non-school-age children and they're in daycare with a nanny. Well, that's ridiculous. So that's why I say, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, again, is you can't just look at a mom and say that she's employed, so therefore she's a working mother, because that's very misleading. And I never say that you can't work and have children at the same time, ever. It depends, as you're pointing out, on how many children you have and how old they are.
I'm thinking about the picture that emerges in mind when someone talks about working mother. You picture business suit and briefcase.
Yeah.
And then you picture the stay-at-home mom, and you picture, sundress, and the one woman's all made up nicely, wearing Donna Karen, and the other woman is wearing something she got off the rack at Target.
Yeah, she's a frump.
Yeah, she's a frump. Yes, that's exactly the word.
She barely gets out of her sweatpants.
Yeah, if she's lucky. What about that stereotype?
Well, which actually, that's very true in the first year when you're dealing with a newborn. But, it's just ridiculous. It's just more of that stuff that's thrown out there, and that is actually something that I talk about in this chapter, which I guess is why you're bringing it up. That's, the second myth where I talk about how stay-at-home moms are supposedly these traditional types, and working mothers are these liberated women. Well, in fact, of course, today's women are really very similar. Those two groups are very similar in that they have both, generally speaking, been out in the workforce because we are postponing marriage and motherhood today. And so they're no less knowledgeable about the working world than their working mother friend, see, which is very different from what we conjure in our mind back from the 50s when women did go straight from college to domesticity and didn't really work in the working world. So it's very, very different today.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on working mothers, give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and internet callers always get top priority. Suzanne Venker is our guest. She's author of the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, what about the boredom factor? I could never stay home full-time with my kids. I would die from boredom.
Yeah, well, there's several things that I talk about with respect to that myth. The first thing is this idea that motherhood or raising children it gives you these moments of boredom, and I kind of scoff at that and laugh and think, oh my God, my full-time mom friends would just love to be bored. How can you be bored? You know, you have to remove the children from you to actually have hours in front of you with nothing to do. So that's what I think of when I think of boring. Now, I do talk about the fact that the work is often monotonous. And I concede to that, and I try to distinguish between what's boring and what's monotonous. But then I go on to explain that is unfortunate that we focus on the fact that the work itself is monotonous or can be monotonous, because so can work outside the home, quite frankly. And you're not going to be stimulated and excited every moment of your life, and that's not the point of motherhood anyway. So I lead into the idea of today's generation being needing to be constantly stimulated and having their own needs met at every moment in order to be, you know, fulfilled and happy, when there's so much that can be gained and gleaned from children when we force ourselves to slow down and let them kind of run the game, run the show.
Someone says, okay, yeah, but think about the things that the mother, full-time mom at home, is going to be doing. I mean, she's going to be sweeping and vacuuming, and as you well know, I know well, children are just walking hurricanes.
Yes.
They leave nothing untouched and always require to be cleaned up after. It's that domestic duties, those kind of chores. My whole day spent doing chores?
Well, see, that's another funny thing. When I talk about the whole domesticity of motherhood, I, again, compare our lives today as women with those of our own mothers, and certainly our grandmothers, who they really knew what domesticity was. I mean, really, it's kind of embarrassing that we complain at all about having to keep up one's house. I mean, that's just a part of life, but today it is as easy as it could possibly be, and there isn't that drudgery that existed so many years ago. We should be celebrating that and be grateful and understand that we actually have more time than any other mothers did in the history of time to actually not have to be bogged down with drudgery and to be spending our time with our children. So this idea that we're all on our floors, scrubbing our floors, and miserable is just silly. Most moms are out because they can be, because modern conveniences have allowed them to do that.
So to come back to that whole notion of being liberated, if someone thinks about being at home with the kids as, you know, this is going to be some sort of indentured servitude, our modern and free and affluent society has pretty much made that a thing of the past.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, it only has to be as domestic as you want it to be. I guess that's what I'm saying. In other words, you can be a full-time mom and use a lot of convenient foods if you wanted to. It's very expensive. I don't recommend it. But there are ways, in other words, of making it very, and people do all the time. I know lots of full-time moms who are not even remotely domestic, but they're home with their children. So it doesn't have to be the way that it was for our own mothers and grandmothers. And that's liberation. That's freedom.
Let's talk about the issue of sacrifice and motherhood. Is sacrifice necessary in motherhood?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no way to skirt having to sacrifice so many aspects of your life by raising children. I mean, it's obvious from the moment they emerge into the world and you bring them home, and all of a sudden you are not important anymore because you can't be, because you physically can't be. The physical needs are just so overwhelming that you can't even take a shower when you want to anymore. And that is the beginning. That's the beginning of a lifelong, world of sacrifice. That's just the way that it is. And, of course, that diminishes to some degree, I think, as they get older. But it's just sacrifice of a different kind. Now, that doesn't mean that you, as, you know, feminists have liked to drill into our heads over the years, that means women have to sacrifice their entire beings and selves. I mean, this is ridiculous. You can do what you are able and what you choose to do when time allows for it. And if you choose to give over your entire being, and certainly there are some mothers who do that, that's a choice you make. But full-time motherhood doesn't cause you to sacrifice your entire being, but it does require enormous sacrifice. And I just try to, delineate between those two in this chapter.
Well, and, is there anything wrong with a life that is lived for other people?
No, and of course, I'm glad you brought that up, because I talk about that as well. That's something I didn't say, and that's, of course, let's talk about what one gains from sacrifice. I think this society would do very well, especially my generation, in learning what one gains by sacrifice. And I even go so far as to say that it's because we are not sacrificing that we are so lost, because we're not gaining that sense of, we're not feeding our souls in that way, and we're lost as to why we are not happy. And I suggest in here that it's because we just think we don't need to sacrifice, and yet there's such a lesson to be learned by sacrificing.
Now, close alongside the issue of sacrifice is the issue of a woman somehow being able to maintain her identity. And this is something that I have heard women who voluntarily stay home with their kids. It's usually put in this form: I just want an adult to talk to. They feel as though their adult sensibilities are, and I think it's natural,
yes,
because they're with the kids all the day long, are atrophying because, you're dealing with children's sensibilities all day long.
Of course. And that's, one of the things I always laugh about is when some working mothers try to explain why they are doing what they're doing, and they concede that it's not, a financial thing, they'll say, well, I just couldn't stay at home all day, hence the title of this chapter, and that I need so much more. And it's so interesting and frustrating, because it's as though the women who are at home full-time don't need that. Most of us do. Most women do. I don't know many women at all who are happy to not have that separate self. It's just that it happens to be a job that you're going to have to work very hard at making sure you retain that. And there are ways, and my only point in the book is that there are ways to do that outside of pursuing full-time careers.
Suzanne Venker, next time we'll be talking about the third myth of motherhood. It usually comes in the form of someone saying, you're so lucky you can stay home. I'm looking forward to that conversation tomorrow on Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you for being our guest. Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher, author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. You can find out more about the book by going to the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com, or call them toll-free. You can order the book here. It's half price, called Seven Myths of Working Mothers, 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. For the remainder of this hour, and to round off our conversation during these 3 hours of Issues Etc., Dr. Victor Raz has joined us here in Studio A. We're going to be talking to him about the Gandhi legacy in India. If you were watching the news this last week, and Sonia Gandhi, who had married into the Gandhi family, was rather overwhelmingly elected Prime Minister of India, and in an unprecedented and, I should say, unexpected move, decided she wasn't going to be Prime Minister of India. This makes a break not only in protocol, but also makes a break in the fact that in one form or another, the Gandhi family has been ruling in India since 1947. We're going to talk about that legacy in this vast country of India with Dr. Victor Raz. Dr. Victor Raz, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello.
First of all, set the context for us. In 1947, this family, the Gandhi family, rose to preeminence in India. How did it happen?
Well, actually, the family that rose to prominence was Nehru family, and Gandhi is the new name that Indira took because of her marriage. So the freedom fighting movement, which was actually the movement of the Indian National Congress, which has long history that rallied people together to bring India to freedom from the British occupation, which was finally accomplished in 1947, August 15th, took a turn of events. Jawaharlal Nehru is the famous name. His dad, Motilal Nehru, was the founding president of this movement. And once India became free in 1947 and hence became a republic in 1950, Nehru, who was also educated overseas, became the first primer of the free independent India. And he went on being the prime minister until his death in 1964. And then there was another person who came to power for about 2 years. And in the meantime, Indira Gandhi has been the only child of Nehru, had been in politics, in the youth movement, and rallying people together for social reform, etc., was also being groomed as a leader. She had already been the party president, at least for a year, prior in the late 50s. And the 2 years Lal Bahadur Shastri was president, prime minister, she was also on the cabinet in charge of the broadcasting media and so on. And Lal Bahadur Shastri met with a death so swiftly in 2 years, and then thereafter she became the prime minister.
I want to pick this up on the other side of the break and continue the story of the Gandhi legacy in India, the world's largest democracy. We'll be talking about that when we come back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. with Victor Raz.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
6 days and gays, what's the connection?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the new booklet, 6 Days or Millions of Years. Well, Ken, you've got me on this one. What's the connection between what a person believes about the 6 days of creation and the homosexual issue?
Actually, it's vital for Christians to understand this connection. It really relates to why our once very Christianized West is becoming increasingly secular. Back in the late 1700s and early 1800s, the idea of millions of years for the age of the earth began to be popularized. Sadly, many church leaders adopted this millions of years idea and began to reinterpret Genesis. So they took the 6 days of creation as long periods and Noah's flood to be a local event. Over the years, the majority of church leaders reinterpreted more of Genesis based on evolutionary ideas. Now, this compromise actually unlocked a door for future generations to reinterpret other parts of Scripture. In the end, this has led to a loss of respect for the Bible's authority, which is no longer considered absolute by the culture as a whole. Thus, doctrines like marriage, which are based in Scripture, are no longer considered to be absolute. That's why we have an exploding homosexual problem. You know, people just aren't building their worldview on the Bible anymore.
Adam and Eve were the first married couple, but have you ever wondered where their son Cain found his wife? For the answer to that often asked question, read Ken Ham's free booklet on our attractive website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. The average American child spends over 20 hours a week watching TV. That means children spend more time watching TV than any other activity except sleeping. That much time in front of the TV seriously displaces quality time with the family. But it needn't be that way. You can set a good example for your children with your own TV habits. Ecclesiastes 3:1 says, "There is a time for everything." In many households, it is high time to unplug the TV and tune in to your family. Celebrate your life of joy and happiness in Christ by sharing the events of your day with the ones you love the most. And at the same time, you will be teaching your children to do the same. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's The Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss how Martin Luther dealt with the other Christians during his day. The other Christians that were outside his movement of the Reformation, how did he deal with them? Our guest will be Dr. Richard Bucher, author of the book The Ecumenical Luther. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. In the last 25 minutes here, Dr. Victor Raj joins us to talk about the Gandhi legacy in India. Dr. Raj is a native of India. He's Associate Professor of New Testament and Assistant Director of the Institute for Mission Studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment on this. It's not only a piece of news, it's also a significant news when we talk about India as the world's largest democracy with over 1 billion citizens. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Raj, let's talk about India as the world's largest democracy. Americans tend to think of democracy in our terms. What is Indian democracy like since 1947, especially given the fact that it is a population that is at least four times the size of the United States? How does democracy work there in that vast nation?
It's an interesting place because it's only next to China in terms of population, and demographic studies indicate that maybe in 25 years, at the most 50 years, we could be outnumbering China. That's quite a bit. And it is interesting to know that in the last elections, they have used the latest state-of-the-art electronic equipments, as well as there have been polling booths where they had to literally carry the boxes on elephant back for a couple of days. So the process took literally 3 weeks to complete. And once the last elections were done, that was, I think, like May 12th or so. By the afternoon, all the results came out because of the latest electronic equipment. So it's a very interesting place. It's approximately 56% literate, and as many have got, 56% of the eligible voters voted. I come from Kerala, the southwestern part of India, which is also the most Christian of all the states, 30%. There, 72% went to the polls. So it's very significant that way.
We talked briefly before the break about the beginnings of the Gandhi legacy. The Gandhi name, of course, is most famous for the famous Gandhi, the mm-hmm. man who eventually becomes the leader of a pacifist movement worldwide. Right. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi was is the father of the nation. He was the leader for the freedom movement that finally brought freedom to the Indian populace from the British occupation. And he was foreign educated. He was himself a lawyer. He was for some time practicing in South Africa. He was a human rights leader, and that was very much in his fabric, and that was his philosophy. So he comes home for the sake of securing freedom for his homeland, and which was his goal. And as we mentioned, Nehru and his family and others were part of the game, but the leader was Mahatma Gandhi, and he chose to be just that. And when independence came for the Indian nation, he stayed away from becoming the ruler, but instead he continued to be the father of the nation. That's how we respect him. And Indira Gandhi takes the last name because she was married to a Gandhi, not related to Mahatma Gandhi, the father of the nation. He married Feroz Gandhi in 1942, and he was a Parsi lawyer. That's how she gets that name. Indira was the only daughter of Nehru, the first prime minister of India, who brought this non-alliance policy, and he had this 5-year plans for the development of the nation, etc. In 1964, he died, and as I mentioned, after a 2-year term by his successor, Indira Gandhi became the prime minister until she was shot by one of her own bodyguards in 1984. That's how she came to met her end. She was a very active person. She had, Indian National Congress is a party, unlike the Congress here in the United States, and that is built on the philosophy of a socialist, secular, democratic government. That's how this party works. After Mrs. Gandhi, Indira Gandhi was the only child of Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, and she was herself in politics, and she had two children, Sanjeev and Rajiv, and Sanjay was the younger one, and he was being groomed as the next in line to be a politician, which he was, but his life, he had a very short span of life. When he was like 36 or less, I think he was flying his own airplane and he got met with an accident. He died. And then Rajiv Gandhi, who was already a pilot, a professional pilot, he was brought back into politics because he was the only remaining child in the Gandhi family. And he got into politics also. Then he was a member of parliament, elected, and then later on after Mrs. Gandhi's death, he would become prime minister. And he too would be killed by a suicide bomber in 1992 or so. So that's how the Gandhi family comes to an end so quickly.
What does it mean that a Gandhi, Sonia Gandhi in mm-hmm. this case, would be elected overwhelmingly to be prime minister in this last election and then demur and say, no, I don't want to be prime minister. I will remain in the position that I have, albeit a political position, but I will remain in the position I'm in. What does that mean to the Indian people?
It means so much, and it was kind of a very surprising, sometimes saddening move from the part of Sonia Gandhi to do this, but it's a very, very heroic decision that she herself on her own took, and she believes, and most of us believe also for the good of the nation at this point, because the issue there was, as I said, Sonia Gandhi is the widow of Rajiv Gandhi, who was, as I said, a pilot, and they later on became Prime Minister of India. However, Sonia is a non-Indian. She is Italian by birth, and this has been brought up, although there is no constitutional basis for this argument, because the issue was never discussed before. It has been brought up as a major issue, especially by the opposition. But the secret was kept a secret until the election. The election was won. Sonia was pretty much a mother, taking care of children, watching the whole scene from the outside. The Congress Party has, for the last 9 years, especially since their opposition had been in power, had been looking for a unifying leader, because India is a very vast nation, different cultures, too many different languages, too many different local parties and whatnot. So usually, one of the reasons, among many other things, a family like Nehru's family comes to the forefront is because they are kind of a neutral ground for everybody to come together. And that is, and we are also somewhat reasonably maternalistic and also paternalistic. And family values are held high, and there is some respect for the next in line.
That's the picture that seemed to emerge to me as I was looking into this whole issue and the news started to come out on this, is that India as a nation, you say, in this vast country with a huge population, often has very prominent women leaders in it. Sonia Gandhi, only one among many. You mentioned Indira Gandhi as well. How can this be? How much does it does the answer to that question factor into the religious makeup of India, and the way the religious faiths that make up the kind of the patchwork of India value, as you say, the family, the maternal relationship, India as a vast family of people?
In very practical terms, family is a place, a locus that you can lean onto. You don't necessarily, for the average person, you don't have access to credit cards or that kind of an independent living. When you need help, you need to lean on human beings. And in this case, the place you can count on, the community that you can count on, is your immediate family. That is very much in the psyche and the fabric of the Indian community. And then when you have husband and wife, father and mother, usually children have a tendency to go to the mother to plead their case even before their father. And in that way, a mother becomes a loving, caring, reconciling person in the whole household. So she does hold a specific position in the household. In this case, I think it works. At least in our culture, it has worked, even politically.
Now, it was noted in the press that we have a coming together of not only cultures but also religions in the latest news. That is, Sonia Gandhi, as you said, raised an Italian-raised Roman Catholic, who turns down the prime ministership. The lot then falls to a Sikh, who will be installed into that position by a Hindu. Talk to us about the religious diversity that you find there in India.
I think this is very unique, especially in this new election situation. This is, I hope and pray that this is going to continue this way, because by constitution, this is a secular, democratic, socialistic republic, which it continued to be for such a long time, as much as Congress Party was in power, which is more than 25 plus years continuously. And suddenly there was a change. And unlike the United States, I do not even know how to count the different parties that are all over the place.
More than 1.1 billion people, that's
right.
Pretty tough.
Yeah, it is pretty tough. And the ballot paper is so big, you got to include all these names. In some constituencies, more than 400 candidates for one position. That is definitely the case. And you obviously know that India is about 84%, 82% Hindus, and about 11-12% Muslims, and about under 3% Christians and Jains and so on. So that's the makeup of. So naturally, there is this thought that all Indians are Hindus. That's a fundamental issue. And the BJP party that has been in power almost 9 years since the Congress met a major defeat 9 years ago, the BJP has been in power, definitely dominated by the Hindu philosophy, although they never had a significant margin. They happened to be the party with the most seats in the parliament. They would still be in a coalition to have a government. And the nation kind of found it necessary for a change, and they opted out of that situation and voted the Congress in power. Here also, they do not have absolute majority, but they have enough secular-minded parties that rallied behind them. That's how the whole situation came into being. And the election, the selection of Singh is also very significant. I must add another interesting quip here. Manmohan Singh was, in fact, born in today's Pakistan.
Now, that's very interesting.
And the chief of the state of Pakistan was born not too far from New Delhi.
In India?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
In fact, he's just a stone throw away. His home is a stone throw away from New Delhi.
Now, this is the next logical question,
uh-huh.
and that has to do with Pakistan.
Right.
The what seems to be an historic animosity between Hindus and Muslims for some reason. Mm-hmm. I would like you to explain the friction between Pakistan, and now that's hopeful to hear that their mm-hmm. leaders are respectively born in the other person's country,
mm-hmm.
but what is the source of the friction between Pakistan and India?
It is, in very simple terms, sibling rivalry. That is my own expression. In another sense, there is a strong sense of religion involved in this, because Pakistan is almost 98% Muslim, and India is 82.3% Hindus. But if you took headcount, perhaps there is one Muslim in India for each citizen of Pakistan. That's how the
so the Muslim population in India alone is as large as the population of Pakistan itself.
Yes. So it is significant in number. India is obviously the fourth largest Islamic nation in the world if you take the headcount. Not Iran, Iraq, or Afghanistan, but Indonesia is number one in terms of Islamic population. Then you have the Bangladesh, which until 1971 was East Pakistan, and now India, and then what used to be West Pakistan, now called Pakistan. That is the Islamic Belt. We are talking about more than 500 million Muslims living in these four countries.
So half of the world's Muslims live there?
Yes. In the Indian subcontinent, to be literally true. And in 1947, when the Indian subcontinent became free from the British, August 15, the same night, what is now called Pakistan was separated from India as West Pakistan, and what is now Bangladesh became East Pakistan, two independent nations, severing off from the Indian subcontinent and India becoming its own. So this was a very, very heartbreaking moment for Mahatma Gandhi, who was the leader, and also Jinnah, the leader of the Islamic movement there. So that is why Singh, who is now 71 years old, and the Pakistani chief, who was born in 44 or so, they both, even though born in today's different countries, they are able to be citizens and leaders of their respective nations. And it's very interesting. And Singh's family moved to India from like 40 or 60 miles away from the present Pakistan's capital. And Singh was about 9 years old when he moved to India. And the Musharraf's family moved to Pakistan about when he was like 4 years old. So they are in that sense native Pakistanis and Indians.
We're talking about the Gandhi legacy in India with Dr. Victor Raj. If you have a question or comment, feel free to join us at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. If we could roll back to Mahatma Gandhi for just a moment, as you called him several times, the father of the Indian nation, what was his personal religious conviction, and how did he view Christianity, and how has that influenced the Indian people's view of Christianity since?
Gandhi and Nehru and people like that are what we call world citizens, though it's kind of difficult to find their religious persuasion. They are practically secularists, but they are not atheists. They are spiritual people. And Gandhi had been in jail as much as Nehru has been. Gandhi, obviously, more than Nehru had been. And it was Gandhi's request to the guards that he would be allowed to have a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, which is a Hindu scripture, as well as the New Testament. There was hardly a day Gandhi went to bed without reading at least the Sermon on the Mount. That's how he was. And even some liberal theologians have called Gandhi more a Christian than most other Christians. So that's, I mean, if you talk about ethics and morality and humility and a life of service to others and so on, Gandhi was an ideal Christian.
You put that in quotes, of course.
I definitely put that in quote. In terms of personal faith, Gandhi counted Jesus Christ probably Jesus as a revolutionary leader, a person who had his heart going out for the poor, the oppressed, the downtrodden, and so on. He did not have a concept of the Messiah who takes the sin of the world, and he did not believe in that. And for Gandhi, Jesus set a model to follow as a life-giving sacrifice. He would use that expression as well.
How did he view Christianity then? Those who do believe and did believe that Jesus Christ is not just a model of sacrifice, but the sacrifice for sins for all mankind. How did he view Christians?
He believed Christianity as a social movement, a movement for the poor, a movement for the oppressed, a movement for people to become themselves, be humanized and come to their senses. That's how Jesus was for him a social reformer who fought the authorities to bring freedom and identity and meaning and purpose in the lives of people, even to the extent of dying for other people. God incarnate taking the place of a sinful human being, and because of the human sin, dying on the cross is not part of Gandhi's vocabulary as he speaks about Jesus Christ.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Those are our call-in numbers. Let's talk with Sherry. She's calling from her car. Sherry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello. I was curious, Dr. Raj. I work with a lot of people who, actually, they're from all over the world, but a majority of them are from India. And I'm just curious, what would be a good approach to begin witnessing to, you know, some of the Hindu people that I work with?
Good question. Sherry, thank you very much. Dr. Raj.
Very interesting question, especially these days, and particularly here in the United States, when all religions have freedom of expression. In fact, they claim more than Christians these days, and they're granted that. It is such a challenging question. And Sherry, you're right. And most friends have told me that I was the most joyful and happy Christian, happy Indian they ever met. And I have humbly attributed that to my faith in my Lord Jesus Christ. And I wonder if others are able to do that. This is definitely a challenge. And Indians, for the most part, are gentle and kind and loving. And you will find it so difficult to tell them that you are actually going to hell because you don't believe in Jesus Christ, because they don't allow you that opportunity. So love is still the strategy. Care is still the strategy. And not only by word of mouth, but also by actions. Hold them in the tender care of Jesus Christ. But demonstrate also, I'm just giving you ideas which you already know, demonstrate before them that you are doing this not because of your own, not on your own, but because of the love of Christ that compels you to do this. This is hard. This is hard because they believe in pluralism, and they have come to a nation where pluralism reigns. And we are presenting Jesus Christ as the only way to heaven, the one who pays for somebody else's sin. And that is a strange language for them.
Sin, the word sin is
sin,
strange.
Sin is such a strange. They understand sin, but sin is something that needs to be paid for by the sinner himself or herself. That is how they look at it. So someone else. I mean, here we know there is no such thing as a free lunch. And that is exactly how they look at their salvation, unfortunately. And this is not humanly done in 5 minutes. It is by association. It is by demonstrating in our life that we are what we are because of Jesus Christ. And there comes that the Lord brings opportunities in our lives when our friends, even from India, are hit hard. If Sherry's friends are like my friends from India, they live in much bigger homes than I do. They drive much better cars than I do, and they make much more money than I do. And they have come here and received all that. But isn't there something more, even which Americans cannot offer? Even our own economy cannot offer? Is not life greater than all these things? And do their religions help them answer that question? That's usually how I deal with the issue. And it is such a difficult situation there, indeed. And this is the best we can do.
With only a minute here, Dr. Raj, the Indian, you mentioned Gandhi's perception of Christianity. Does that carry over into the modern Indian, the way that the Hindu, say, for to talk about the majority, would view the Christian? What do we need to tell them about the Christian faith, first and foremost, to dispel any myth that they may entertain about that?
Yeah, it works. What we call the theology of the cross works, surprisingly and not surprisingly, among the poorer sections of the people. I mean, there they see love in action. There they see Christians going out with an extended arm to help them out in their difficult situations and then bringing them into a household of faith. There actually, it works. It does work. Jesus Christ becoming the poorest of the poor and associating with them. And not only giving them blessings to live here, but also ultimately giving them the greatest gift of life. It does work. Even today, 21st century included, that message works much better than arguing the faith. Mm. Yeah, it works much, much better than arguing the faith. It does happen. The dialogical method works at the intellectual level, 1 out of 10,000. But if you take a head count, you probably have 100 out of 1,000 coming to faith because of our actions and serving people and letting them know that this is done for them and this message is brought for them, not on our own account, but because of the one who did everything for us on the cross. It works that way, definitely.
Dr. Victor Raj, thank you for being our guest, for coming here in studio and talking to us about the legacy of Gandhi in India and so much more.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Victor Raj is a native of India. He is Associate Professor of New Testament and Assistant Director of the Institute for Mission Studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Now tune in again tonight from 8 until 9 for the rebroadcast of our first hour discussion here on Issues Etc. We talked with Dr. Andrew Steinman on the Book of Esther and had a little bit of open lines there. Tune in from 8 to 9 tonight. If you don't have an opportunity now, from 8 to 9, tune in and listen to the first hour of Issues Etc. Tomorrow on the program, Luther and how he dealt with other Christians with whom he disagreed. Pastor Richard Bucher will be our guest tomorrow on the program to talk about that. He has written a new book called The Ecumenical Luther. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.